Today is July 7th, right? 2010, 7-7-10. And I'm Rick Hansen. Last week I spoke about embodiment. And it's one of the kind of three central topics that really came to me after the close to a month, one way or another, retreat I did in June just recently. The other two being relinquishment and love. And so, if you want to hear the talk I gave fresh off retreat a week ago, I think some good stuff was coming through. And you could hear it. The talk is posted. The larger context here is an engagement with the pillar of practice in Buddhism that is about steadying the mind, seeing clearly, and on the basis of that, deepening virtue and deepening wisdom. It's the, in Buddhism, samadhi pillar of practice, so-called. There's sila, virtue, samadhi, concentration or mindfulness, and punya, which means wisdom. So that's what we're focusing on this year. And for the first, mostly half of the year, we've been really zeroed in on the body. And I thought to get out of the body section, we ought to do so with a big bang. So we really went after it with embodiment last week. What's the point of all that? What's the point of getting into the body? The ultimate point in Buddhism is freedom from suffering, which in the Buddhist model, which you don't have to buy, as the Buddha said, ehi passiko, see for yourself most fundamentally. In that model, getting out of suffering means getting out of craving. And on the basis of which, finding what the Buddha called the highest happiness, which is peace. So how do we actually do that? So tonight I'd like to talk with you about a central theme in Buddhism called relinquishment and kind of unpack that word, which can sound fancy and off-putting and even horrible. Like, who in America would ever want to relinquish anything except their credit card debt, right? Or maybe their in-laws, but we won't go there too much tonight. So here we go. And my hope is to kind of hold forth for a bit and then open it up for some discussion and situations and then hold forth a little more and try to end pretty close to 8:30. Okay? And actually, as I do this, first let me truly say from my heart, I just feel so heartened to see you here. You know, I really do. You're going out of your way on a Wednesday night. Wow. I just want to say that, you know, as we dive into this stuff. Okay. So the context here, to kind of bring it down to earth, is what to do about desires. And what to do, for example, about the stuff we want that we know isn't good for us, or the things that we know are good for us, but it's really hard to sustain our motivation for. And to make it real, think about it. You know, think about the number of good intentions we have. What fraction of those do we actually live by day in and day out? Or on the other hand, think about emotional triggers. You're going along through life and something happens, someone cuts you off, they're clearly in the wrong, and nonetheless they flip you off. Or you're with a family member who you've really put your heart out for, a child, a mate, an in-law, and they just blow off some kind of agreement with you as if it doesn't matter or act like you don't matter. Things happen, right? Emotional reactions arise that we want to act on. What do we do then? So this issue of self-control in psychology terms, because my background is in psychology as well as in the Dharma, psychological terms, the issue of self-regulation, self-control, motivation, intention, they're really important themes. So I thought tonight I could actually start with the brain and talk about some of the latest research and thinking and modeling of the causes and conditions of healthy, useful, productive wanting, broadly defined, as those causes and conditions manifest in the body mind, as well as how problematic desires, compulsions, addictions, or inhibitions about pursuing important aims, how those also manifest in the body mind. And then move out from that to an even bigger picture in terms of the Buddha's own insights and his teachings. Right. And as I do this, I really encourage you, if you could, maybe to think about two things. One, think about something that you know that you're doing or comes up for you to do, but it's a problem for you. Like, you really shouldn't drink so much, right? Or you really shouldn't have this kind of flaring, angry reaction to various political figures on cable news or people in your life. You know, as I've quoted before, as Jean-Paul Sartre, as only a French existentialist could say, hell is other people, right? Okay, other people, whatever it is. In other words, something that you feel you wish you were better at controlling, okay? A desire that's problematic. Or maybe, honestly, it's a more conventional desire that's quite rewarded, but it's really quite problematic. Like a desire toward a kind of top-down, intense, driven, hard-working, quote-unquote, masculine style in business. That's highly rewarded, but there's a fair amount of collateral damage. Or, you know, a longing for what in psychology are called narcissistic supplies, you know, approval, acceptance, cherishing, that's way over the top, that's a problem for you. So pick something that you've been wanting to control or regulate and has been an issue for you, so it's real for you. And the other thing is think of something that you wish you could mobilize more around, you could naturally move more toward, or you find yourself doing it, you know, one day in four, one day in five, you know, so or you 10 days in a row and then you flame out yet again. You know, what is that? All right. For many people, a good example of that is a significant amount of daily meditation, like half an hour or more. All right, so make it real for yourself. All right, so now, neuropsychology. Generally speaking, to simplify it, there's a basic model of desire that talks about two systems that intertwine with each other in the regulation of wanting or goal-directed pursuits, etc. A hot system and a cool system. Now, the hot system tends to be top-down. So in terms of, pardon me, the hot system is bottom-up. In terms of evolution, we evolved, the brain evolved kind of like a tree, up and out, all right? Brainstem up, limbic system kind of in the middle, mammals and birds, and then cortex, more cortex, you know, primates, and then humans, okay? So the lower system, it's got the brainstem, got the limbic system, it's quick to react, tends to have a lot of energy, a lot of juice. It's where Freud's id is located, if it's located anywhere. These primal desires, sexuality, appetite, thirst. Let's not forget that the origin of the word for craving in Buddhism, tanha, is thirst. Right? Very primal, very immediate, very visceral. Right now I feel a little thirsty. My mouth is dry. I can feel that. I want it. You know, hold your breath for 30 seconds, 45, past the point of comfort, wanting that breath, wanting that air. You know, it's that visceral, right? Very, very deep. That's the hot system, okay? Then there's a cooler system, quote unquote, that's more top down. It's more cerebral, literally. It takes a longer view. It's more driven around language, abstraction, concepts, complication. That's, if anywhere it's located, that's where the superego lives, right? So here we have this classic tension, right? Seemingly. Between this hot system and this cool system, okay? The head says, get up in the morning to exercise. The cool system says, get up in the morning and exercise. The hot system says, when the alarm goes off, forget about it. You know, I'm right in the middle of this nice dream, forget about it, okay? All right? It's actually more complex than that. Although, I'll give you one more example. In the brain, to kind of really make it quite concrete, I read an interesting study recently about people who are overweight who had issues with eating. So in the study, they basically showed them different foods and had them rate the foods in terms of health and deliciousness. All right? And then in an MRI, or so their brain is being scanned, they were asked, which foods will you actually choose to eat? The cookie or the carrot, let's say, okay? And what's interesting was that, first of all, when people were evaluating how pleasurable or how rewarding, let's say, how desirable something was, like a health goal, like being trimmer, looking better, getting control of type 2 diabetes, living longer, sticking around for the grandchildren, whatever. Or what people were rating the deliciousness of different foods, like a Butterfinger candy bar, right? Or a cookie, or whatever your favorite yummy, yummy food is, right? When they were doing that, a part of the brain, basically in the middle, right behind the eyes, medial prefrontal cortex, and they were just looking at the prefrontal cortex, the more modern parts of the brain, all right? So they were looking at variations within the cooler systems of the brain, as it were. These parts really lit up. It's as if there was a kind of summary or signal of how desirable the object was that was involved with the activation of the medial, middle, prefrontal cortex, and not centered either left or right, okay? Kind of in the middle, all right? On the other hand, when people were fundamentally deciding, should I do this or not? And they were making a fundamental kind of judgment. In other words, you imagine how it is inside yourself. It's like you want something, but then you kind of decide, well, is that really good for me, or will I pay a big price, or what should I do? Or, you know, will other people see me eating the cookie? You know, I better take that into account. I got a reputation as a dietitian. What am I going to do? My wife has issues like that. We won't go there, but anyway. So in that case, upper outer portions of the brain lit up, especially on the left-hand side. It's a little bit as if the part of the brain that really makes this determination about is something, you know, really desirable or not is kind of here in the center. And upper outer is where the part of the, where, in some sense, I'm really simplifying here, the conscience lives that says, you know, you really shouldn't do that. All right? Interestingly, the people who went for the cookie had very little activation in the upper outer regions, kind of pure desire, unregulated desire. Whereas the people that really wanted that cookie, so they got a pretty good signal here, but then had a growing signal in the upper outer portion of the brain, which was correlated with a diminishing signal right around here, all right, those people were able to make a healthier choice, at least in their mind. So to eat something that was, you know, reasonably good, but not as satisfying as a Twinkie. All right, you see that? So you see the distinction there? Now, for me, that's all kind of interesting, but it's a lot more complicated than that. On the one hand, you can think of the number of times that we've developed this kind of rationale or justification for a desire that's a problem, right? And in fact, deep down in the gut, where it's so-called hot, we know deep down we shouldn't do it. We should not have that third drink. We should not just let it rip at our kid when we've had it up to here. We just feel it inside. We really shouldn't. Or we just should not get our head all twisted around what somebody else said to us at work that day. But then up here, there's this long verbal rationale. Just this once. It's really okay. No one will know. You've worked so hard. Right? That's a good one. You deserve it. You know, they've been bad in various ways. And right? And it's like worm tongue in our head, that character in Lord of the Rings who whispers in King Theoden and tricks him and twists his mind. That part, you know, is kind of twisting our head, twisting our mind. Its verbal center is this prefrontal cortex. In other words, this supposedly cool part of the brain can be involved in problematic desire. Classically, you know, the traditional view, Freud was not alone in this view, is that cool is good, hot is bad. You know, hot is savage, hot is primitive, hot is young, hot is bestial, hot is feminine. Ooh, problematic there, you know. And then cool is lofty, angelic, etheric, right? Civilized, rational, logical, masculine. And you can see the problems, right? Hasn't hot's gotten a bad rap? Cool. There's a kind of prejudice in favor of cool against hot. And I want to challenge that somewhat. It's also the case that, as I said in my example, the so-called hot lower things, the brainstem, the emotions, the gut, can incline us in very wholesome directions, toward love, toward movement, toward enthusiasm. The root of the word enthusiasm is endeos, God within, you know? It's that kind of thing. All right? So it's not just cool, good, hot, bad. Right? And then last, something that's really left out in this hot-cold dichotomy is the role of internalized others in motivation. For example, bringing inside ourselves the felt sense of those who love us and care about us, or kind of encourage us or coach us in positive directions, which is often very saturated with hot, warm feelings, right, of nurturance and encouragement. Those characters inside ourselves, who are very warm-hearted, can really move us in positive directions. Okay? So far? So any comments or questions so far? And then we'll head really into the deep end of the pool. Okay? One thing I will say in passing is that, it's like they say in real estate, the key to real estate is location, location, location. I think the key to life in many ways is motivation, motivation, motivation. You know the old joke about how many therapists it takes to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. Yeah? You may have heard that before. It's kind of lame but profound as well. Right? And so if you want to help yourself incline increasingly toward what's good for you and others, which is really the path of awakening, really, certainly within Buddhism and in my own training and experience in other traditions as well. It's about that as well, to increasingly help ourselves be given over to the best, to the best, to the best within us, to the best around us, to the best arising as us. To give ourselves over to that increasingly is a path of practice. How do we actually do that, though? Moment by moment, in the face of all the challenges of life, particularly when we live as householders, when we're surrounded by this world of wonders, you know, where the best minds of our generation are designing ever more clever ways to trick our minds and our brains into wanting things we don't really need. One of my friends was a professor emeritus of business, and he said, you know, in the business school, we basically have really, really smart people help advertisers and marketing companies and so forth figure out ever more clever ways to bypass conscious control and get people to want things that are going to make those companies money. And that's the world we live in. You know, how do we do it? So I'll talk at the end about some basics that have to do with kind of the biggest picture of all, but before I get there, I'll just mention a few things in passing that I've seen are really, really important for inclining the mind in an increasingly positive direction. One is to really reward it when it goes to the right place, or it imagines going to the right place. At the macro level, the mind is brilliant. At the micro level, it's really stupid. It's a bunch of little modules, all right? And they are very organized around rewards. So if you find yourself doing what in your mind is truly the right thing, really savor the rewards of that. You know what I mean? If you hold your fire in a meeting or conversation, if you get up early and go exercise, if you stop at two glasses of wine and don't have that third one or whatever it is and you feel better in the morning or you don't have anything to drink at all or whatever it is, if you do those things, really, really focus on the rewards and sink those rewards in. The brain will increasingly just naturally move in that direction. Right? Another is to really involve this felt sense of others with you who want you to go toward the light, you know, who want you to move toward the very best, whatever that is that makes sense to you. That felt sense of the internalized other is something that is very native to our evolution. We evolved to have that very strong sense of the internalized other. And consciously bringing it to mind, you know, a felt sense of a coach or a friend, a loving grandmother, a spiritual teacher. I think back on my own therapist and her just blue eyes. That's the thing I mostly remember. He's just her looking at me with this quality of kindness and clear seeing and no bull and encouragement. In my own perverse way of doing it, I think of Coach Singletary of the 49ers. You know, for me, it's kind of this tough love, good guy. And I think, what would Mike say if I want to wuss out around exercise? This would not go over well at all. You know, whatever works for you, your own version of that. That's the second thing I would really encourage you about. And then the last is, if you slip or blow it, whatever, don't use that as an excuse to stop. You know, on my own retreat, a long time ago, pretty many years ago, I came across a small round pebble on the beach, and I wanted something to remind myself of my own commitment, my own aspirations toward awakening. So I picked it up and I put it in my pocket, and I kept it in my pocket for years and years. And I'd move it from, I always had it, so I became familiar to touch it. Recently, I had it in my pocket because it's pretty much a part of my life, and I hung up my pants and it fell out and it hit this tile floor and it cracked open. And the first time I did it, it felt okay, but the second time I did it, I felt I need a new thing. So on retreat, it was at a very meaningful moment on a long walk coming down from the ridges above Spirit Rock, very deep in, you know, my own process. I just came across this other pebble at a particular point that meant a particular thing to me. And most fundamentally, it was at the halfway point between the ridge and coming down into where the people were. And it really meant to me, keep going. So when I touch this pebble that's in my left pocket right now, it comes to me as the sense of keep going. So that's the third thing I would say, in a fairly practical way, that can help us keep inclining, you know, toward, you know, what's really good for us. That's what the Buddha called wise effort, where we keep encouraging the arising maintenance and the increase of what's wholesome, and we keep encouraging the prevention, the decrease, and the complete elimination of what's unwholesome. We keep going. Okay? And if you feel moved to find a special little pebble or something and put it in your pocket or, you know, on your computer table or what have you, you know, feel really, really free. Okay? So now let's kind of broaden this sort of neuropsychological view of helping ourselves want what's good for us and live our lives increasingly given over to that moment to moment to moment. There's a bigger picture than simply inhibiting negative desires and promoting positive ones. In Buddha Dharma, there's a focus on relinquishing desire altogether, particularly desire in the Buddha's meaning of it, as a sense of something that grips us, that grabs us, that carries us, right? Which is distinct, and I'll get to that toward the very, very end, from wholesome, just the natural wholesome movement of the heart that doesn't have this feeling particularly of desire or gotta. There's just a natural movement in that direction. There isn't even a top-down, you really ought to be a nicer person. You really ought to meditate more. None of that. There's just a natural movement in that direction. You know. Okay. So in terms of that, how in the world do we relinquish desire altogether? Because you recall that in the Noble Eightfold Path, wise intention is the second of the elements listed. One of the three elements of wise intention is renunciation. Across all kinds of traditions, there's a great recognition, Hindu, Christian, shamanic, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, etc., etc., that getting carried away by our desires is a problem. What are we going to do about desire? The thing is, though, from an evolutionary standpoint, we evolved to want. We evolved to want food, to want mating, to survive. And our ancestors that were not really strong about wanting, they got chewed up in the evolutionary machinery. They didn't pass on their genes, and they're not here today. We are the great-grandchildren of people, of creatures that were really good at craving, right? What are we going to do about it? And you can watch the mind do that. Like, for example, on retreat, you can see yourself do it as well in daily life. There you are. You're perfectly relaxed. You're perfectly contented. You know, everything's really okay. And you can observe your mind looking for something to want, right? Or looking for a problem to solve. we evolved these systems that are pretty hot. You know, whether they're hot or cool, they are continually looking for something to want. All right, and what are we going to do about that? It's a real issue. So, some of the advice that's given is based on insight. So, for example, one is to have insight into the degree to which desire is automatic and just another object of awareness. If you think about it, when a desire arises, very often it's as if, the order's been given and we got to go get it. But desire is like a sound, a sensation, a thought. It's just another content of mind, you know? It's just one more thing flowing through the open space of awareness. And if we orient to it in that way, we can begin to see that it's just another arising content of mind. Second, there is, certainly in Buddhism, a focus on disenchantment. That's a key word, a growing sense of disenchantment, where there's a growing clarity that, the pleasant is kind of pleasant, and the unpleasant is kind of unpleasant, but really, most of the time, it's not that big a deal. For myself, I kind of have updated that by reflecting on what I call the simulator, which is this, in the brain, this kind of global workspace where future and past are simulated. You know, when your mind is kind of wandering, it's as if it's sort of real. And a lot of what we do is we have anticipatory vedana. What I mean by that is that we anticipate whether something will be pleasant or unpleasant. And we strategize internally about what to do about it, right? Or we get involved internally about thinking how to maximize my pleasures here, or I better avoid that unpleasant thing there. But isn't it interesting that if you look closely, the rewards that are cast up in the simulator feel really like they're going to be pretty good, you know? And the bad things get laid out to be, oh my goodness, really, really nasty. Oh, I'm just going to feel so bad if I let them say that to me out ever again. Standing up at that meeting and speaking up, I'm just going to feel really horrible. But in fact, isn't it interesting that you can see again and again and again when you go to the actual event itself, it actually is rarely that pleasant or unpleasant. Most of life is kind of in the middle, right? Plus 1 or 2, minus 1 or 2, on the plus 10 to minus 10 hedonic scale in psychology, it's mostly somewhere in that narrow band around minus 1 to plus 1. But in the simulator, those carrots and those sticks are really, really intense. But the simulator's lying to us. And with practice and with time, we wake up from that enchantment, from the spell it casts over us. We're not so carried away by it. More deeply even, we start to appreciate, under the heading of disenchantment, that there is a certain amount of what the Buddha called dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering or stress. There's a certain amount of dukkha just innate in life. You know, as I said last time, the root of the word dukkha is wonderful, I think. De means problematic, and ka is where the axle meets the hub of a wheel. I think of it as kind of a wobbly grinding. It's off center, it's not quite right. There's a strain, there's a quality of strain, pressure, push, contraction, tension, irritation, heat, right? Dukkha. And, the truth is, there's a certain amount of dukkha that's just inevitable. What normally happens is the mind gets organized around getting rid of it. And, hey, there's a place for that. Fix the leaky roof, go to the dentist for that toothache, find a better job, right? Turn the channel, something like that. But, irreducibly, there is just an inevitable amount of strain, pressure, stress. And if we get more comfortable with that fact, and don't make it into a personal problem, And if we don't feel so offended, I think often we kind of feel offended, especially again culturally. Many cultures, they're used to inevitable pain and suffering. They're not offended by it. They don't take it personally. They don't feel somehow entitled to not suffer, to not have discomfort. I think about younger people, including my own kids, a level of discomfort that my parents' generation would hardly have noticed is, you know, to my kids means dead stop. No way am I going to deal with that. You know? Dukkha. It's just dukkha. It's just, it's the of life. But instead of getting worked up about it and activating a lot of desire around it, to just simply hold it as an experience, then we're not so caught by desire. We can move increasingly. In other words, relinquishing the hope that we can ever fully escape suffering, particularly in its subtler forms. Then also there's the recognition that experiences themselves, which is really interesting, are fundamentally transient and insubstantial. Like, you look at me, I look at you, I think there are bodies there. Now, I happen to think there are real bodies there. You look at me, and I really am here, okay? I don't care how much Shirley MacLaine you've read, I really am here, okay? Really, I am here. I don't care what the Course in Miracles said, I really am here. Believe it, I'm here. But that said, you just look at life as experience and kind of bypass the inference that there's a physical object out there. If you just focus on the pure phenomenology of your experience, the thoughts, the feelings, the sensations, you just look at experience itself. Isn't it amazing how transient experiences are? In terms of the neural substrates of awareness, these coalitions of synapses form in like 1 to 3 tenths of a second. They kind of form. I think of them as an eddy, a kind of swirling, self-organizing pattern. They form, these eddies form, they last 2 to 3 seconds, and then they disperse, freeing up those synapses to form new coalitions in new ways. That's literally about how it happens. Almost no thought lasts for more than 2 or 3 seconds. And you can see that, right? When you're meditating and your mind's quiet. Their experience as experience is extremely transient. And it's kind of insubstantial. The experience itself, like the taste of an orange, right? Or a nice sight, or even something that's unpleasant, like the blaring of a horn, right? Or a pain in your knee. Even that has this fundamentally insubstantial quality. And as one deepens in practice and the mind gets increasingly quieter, it becomes increasingly clear how profoundly and pervasively experiences are transient and insubstantial. And as transient and insubstantial, they cannot be that satisfying. That was the Buddha's great insight, one of his great insights, but that experience is fundamentally transient, insubstantial, and inherently unsatisfying. It's okay if it's pleasant, it's to be managed if it's unpleasant, but fundamentally, it's not a basis, a reliable basis for lasting true happiness. And there's a growing recognition of that. And on the basis of that growing recognition, people increasingly stop looking for true, reliable, profound, deeply fulfilling happiness in experiences and in the conditions that create experiences. Maybe I'll say a couple more things and then see if you have a question or two, and then finish with some more practical stuff. In fact, what happens for people, and I can tell you personally, it is happening more and more for me, there's this growing sense that's described, you know, traditionally, of things disappearing and appearing very rapidly. So there's this growing sense of things falling away and reemerging, but with a growing sense that I talked about last time, that there's a kind of inherent groundlessness to things. The analogy I used last week was like out of a film. You imagine being on the 21st floor and pushing the button for the elevator to come, and you step out and whoosh, there's no floor there. except you don't fall through it. You know, everything is disappearing. And you don't know if it'll ever come back. You don't know if anything will return the next instant, but it keeps on doing that. And in the process of that, you know, disappearing, you get this growing sense that it's actually kind of futile to try to get what you want, because it's all going so fast. For many people, at that point, it's really quite uncomfortable. If you've ever experienced that, or hung out there, maybe on retreat or in general, that's when people talk about, traditionally, they talk about, you know, packing up their cushion, you know, and just leaving. I've had friends who talk about that state that in a way that is very, very troubling and disorienting. I would say for myself, I've been quite unsettled by it, but I haven't been devastated by it. Who knows? Maybe I will. I don't know. On the other hand, maybe not necessarily. But it can feel quite unsettling, particularly when there's this kind of radical recognition about the endless ending of everything and the, yeah, the impermanence of everything and minimally rewarding nature, the limitedly rewarding nature of any and all experiences. You know, it's like there's an asymptote that you approach. You cannot get more rewards than that. You know, just that's it. And you know, I live in the world. I love doing certain things. I'm, you know, like rock climbing or hanging out with my family or playing bridge with my kids or looking at cool websites, watching food porn. You know, Anthony Bourdain's God. He's a god. But anyway, you know, but there's just this growing sense that is just sand moving through your fingers, you know? And that then moves you increasingly to a sense of kind of relinquishment, where you're disenchanted. You enjoy it when it's there, but you're not organizing your life around getting it, all right? Then what's left, right? The Buddha said his path was not nihilistic. There are stories, actually, of monks who took what he said, this teaching, these teachings are his teachings, they're not my teachings, and killed themselves because they were so despairing. Or they thought, well, this life is awful, just get out of it. And he was very fierce about that. He went, no, not from a moralistic standpoint, but from a practical standpoint. You know, he said, no, you don't get it, you're only partway there. And what happens increasingly, as we do really grow in our awareness of the truth of things. In other words, what he's talking about is not like an idea you should try to attain because it'll make you feel better. He's saying, I hate to break the bad news to you, but this is the way it really is. Experience is incredibly rapidly dispersing. You know, it's deeply transient and minimally fulfilling, per se. Exercises are minimally fulfilling. And whatever fulfillment is in them is very evanescent and usually not at all as much as you hoped it was going to be. Right? Most pains are actually not that awful, and they also usually pass. Okay. So what are you left with then? You know, right? And what you're left with relinquishment, is a radical kind of surrender to and refuge in what is reliable? What is reliable? Experiences are not reliable. Conditions are not reliable. They're always changing. They're out of your control. They're interdependent. You know, hell is other people. All kind of, you know, stuff happens. What do you rely on? Well, what is reliable is what doesn't change. It's what doesn't move. And that is the nature of things. The nature of things is that they're endlessly emergent, endlessly renewing. And in my own personal experience, infused with grace in some mysterious and profound way. And so we increasingly take our refuge in the elevator with no floor, you know? And we realize that, truthfully, there's never been any floor. We kind of thought there was a floor. We made up there was a floor. People told us there was a floor, but there really was never any floor. Things are always endlessly changing, and everything could stop in the next moment, and we don't know whether it will ever come back or not. So we come more increasingly to peace with the nature of things, which really reduces the dukkha because we're not grinding with life so much. And we feel more and more a kind of peace at like the amazingness of the endless arising and disappearing of everything. And that is relinquishment, which entails a kind of radical satisfaction. It's like you're already radically contented. You're already radically fulfilled or satisfied as things, with things as they are. You know, with the deep nature of things as they are. The superficial expressions that are swirling through the nature of things, those eddies, you can't really rely on them, they'll always keep changing. But the underlying streaming and endless self-renewing quality of that, we can take our true home in. We can find our seat in, you know. We can find the fountain, the wellspring, that always keeps feeding us, always keeps nourishing us. That's what's there with relinquishment. I want to read you a few quotes here as I'll move to a wrap shortly from the Buddha. He says, any sensual bliss, any heavenly bliss, so either heavenly or sensual bliss, is not worth 1/16th of the bliss of the ending of craving. Or he says also, if by renouncing a lesser happiness, one may realize a greater happiness, let the wise one renounce the lesser, having regard for the greater. In other words, giving up the lesser happiness of getting the cookies in life for the greater happiness of this unconditional peace. In other words, any kind of peace or happiness based on conditions is what? It's conditional. And it makes you deeply vulnerable, which immediately triggers anxieties. Whereas taking your seat in a sense of the nature of things, you know, trusting increasingly that if you fall back or step into the elevator, that you'll be caught over and over and over again, all right? That is a much more reliable basis for happiness. Says here, whose mind is like rock, steady, unmoved, dispassionate for things that spark passion, unangered by things that spark anger. When one's mind is developed like this, from where can there come suffering and stress? Dukkha. And then he says so much better what I've been trying to say in the last few minutes. He says, the entire world is in flames. In other words, metaphorically speaking, the entire world is going up in smoke. The entire world is burning. The entire world is vibrating. But that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the noble ones, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights. That's the unconditioned. That's the underlying nature of things through which conditions come and go. In that my mind delights. That's the fruit of relinquishment. That's the point of relinquishment. We can't force relinquishment, you know, putting on our hair cloth and beating ourselves and all, you know, all that sort of stuff, hair cloth, garment, what have you. It's not that. You know, relinquishment is a natural unfolding. Keep going wherever you are with regard to relinquishment. But if you're on this path, you know, realize that that's a fundamental blessing to move increasingly into this mind of relinquishment and to really appreciate it when you actually get there. So I want to name a few helpful means that I've personally found to support myself, you know, in this world of wonders in terms of relinquishment or a deepening relinquishment. And I'm not all the way there. I'm certainly not fully cooked, you know what I mean? There are people that are a lot more cooked than I am in this regard. For one, is to get a bodily sense of transience, just like the breath. Breath is fantastic because it teaches us about transience, impermanence, change, moment by moment by moment. You know, just feel it. Like every time you move, something is different. Something has ended. Something is lost. Isn't it remarkable that the moment 1 second ago is utterly gone? I mean, take time from time to time to just really appreciate endings. You know, it's gone. And yet the next moment arises. Isn't that amazing? That's what I'm really talking about. I'm talking about the thing that's right under our noses all the time, which is now. Right in this now, okay? Just when I began that sentence, it's gone. Next moment's not here. The nature of now. That's what I'm talking about. In the nature of now, things endlessly disappear and fall away. And yet something keeps renewing. Wow. Okay. Second, taking a wider view. You know, when we get caught up in something, as soon as we take a wider view, neurologically, we light up these lateral networks, which are great, to take us out of selfing, me, and planning, and future and pasting, which is very much carried by midline networks. The big picture, the wider view, we see the bigger picture. We see things in a larger context. We see, sure, it makes sense to encourage generally wholesome things, but to not do it with attachment, you know, to do it without grabbing after or getting fixated on or compelled about the things that we want to have happen. It's also great to, I wrote here, marinate in natural contentment. In other words, when you find just ordinary contentment and encourage it, open to it. The Buddha totally encouraged us to find natural contentment, even not even the highest contentment necessarily, lesser, more pedestrian or ordinary forms of contentment. When you find a natural sense of okay, it's all right. You know, the dishes are done, the kids are quiet, or it's all right. You know, the world is not blown up today. It's far from a perfect world, but at least in this little corner, really marinate in that. And watch your mind try to take you out of it because it's looking for something to want. You know, the inner iguana is looking for something to eat, right? The inner monkey's scanning for a banana or some new sexual partner or whatever, right? You know, try to let that go and settle back into that natural contentment. Next to last, let yourself be increasingly carried by wholesome desires. You know, without getting attached to what the results are. So wholesome desires like caring for how the world turns out, or expressing your own creativity, creating beauty around you, discovering things more deeply, developing insight, and all the rest of that. You know. Let those. What are your own really, really important desires, right? That are really wholesome. They're hardly even desires, like aspirations or movements, you know, that flow through you from the organism altogether, you know, the person altogether. And then last, for me, you know, when I was most grounded in this elevator shaft experience, in which if you watch your experience as well, you see how unrelated so much of it is to each other. It's just eddies or bubbles in the mind. Thoughts here, feelings there, body sensations kind of coming and going. We tend to string a narrative around them that invents a coherent story. Some research has shown that the left temporal lobes, the language centers, tend to create a story that sort of makes sense about it confabulates, basically, a story that strings together these various beads and somehow tries to put them on a linear chain. But if you really look at experience, as experience, moment to moment, holy jamoly, it's like popcorn popping. It's so much going on. No one can possibly be in charge. It's just popping away. Well, and all that popping away, giving over increasingly, to positive, wholesome movements of the heart, aspirations, is a really wonderful way to help yourself. And what was clear to me when I was kind of most grounded in this sense of relinquishment and just the evanescence, the disappearance, the flame-like transience of everything, is that the only sensible thing a person could do is love. That was the only thing that ever made sense. I think that ever does really make sense. When you're deeply grounded in this very felt sense of falling away. So next week, we'll explore love more. And between now and then, you might explore in your own heart what it's like to kind of explore the sense of disenchantment. Not revulsion, not disgust, just disenchantment. And a growing sense of not knowing what the next moment will bring and not feeling compelled inside that it be any particular way. Wishing appropriately that it be good, but not feeling compelled about that, invested in that. Okay. So let's sit for a minute and then we'll wrap up. And I appreciate you hanging in here a little past 8:30. Notice that as you let go, as you exhale, as you let go in ways small or large, even letting go of needing to be alive in the next second, even in extremes of letting go, notice that there is somehow a renewing upwelling in your life. There is still somehow a wholesome going on being. As the great British child psychiatrist Winnicott said, you can take refuge in that going on being and have faith that you can relinquish and abandon yourself and be caught and carried nonetheless by a beautiful, wholesome stream. Thank you so much for your attention and practice, and may it help free us and others from suffering and its causes. Thank you. See you next week. Keep going.